This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on 90.7 KPFK, talking about what Trump is actually doing, not just what he's tweeting. Later in this hour, we'll ask the question, is Trump like Nixon? If you Google that question, you get more than 4 million results. Rick Perlstein has some answers of his own. He wrote the classic book, Nixonland. First up, Trump is a cornered megalomaniac. That's what Sasha Abramski says. Trump Watch starts right now. Trump's troubles continue to grow. Investigations by the FBI and Congress and talk about impeachment. He's already the most unpopular president in modern history. How is he likely to defend himself as the evidence of crimes becomes stronger and his defenders become fewer? For comment, we turn to Sasha Abramski. He writes regularly for The Nation and other publications. He's the author of several books, including The American Way of Poverty, The House of 20,000 Books, and his new book, which will be published by Nation Books in September, is called Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. Sasha Abramski, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on again.
Well, remind us where Trump stands after his return from his first trip overseas as president. Remind us what's becoming the new normal for the Trump White House.
Well, the new normal is absolute chaos, based around both anonymous leaks that seem to be coming daily to the New York Times, CNN, Washington Post, and so on. But also beyond the chaos, a real sense of dysfunction, that this is an administration that is besieged by crisis. It seems to increasingly be defined by crisis. And it's stumbling from one chaotic episode to another, whether it's the implication that very, very senior people in the White House were in some way colluding with Russia prior to the election, or whether it's the fact that they can't even keep Trump off Twitter long enough to avoid diplomatic chaos with very, very close allies. And you look at what happened when he came back from his 9-day trip, and he immediately began using Twitter for two main sort of ploys. The first was to berate the media again, which is sort of his standard trope. But the second thing was he went after Angela Merkel again. And I don't think you can overemphasize the significance of this, that the transatlantic alliance, which has existed since the end of World War II, so for more than three quarters of a century, pretty much, the transatlantic alliance has been a bedrock. First Britain and America during the Second World War, and then after World War II, the broader alliances of Western Europe, America, Canada, Australia, and so on. And that alliance is being absolutely shattered by, I don't even think you can call it diplomacy, but by the way that Trump is communicating with the rest of the world. And so the sort of new normal for the Trump administration, I think, is, as I said, both chaos and also just utter destruction of values and of institutions and of alliances.
Well, before Trump took office, some pundits expressed the hope that he would mature in the White House, he would moderate his campaign style in view of the responsibilities of the office. Now we are being told that a new team will bring new discipline to the White House. How successful do you think that will be?
Well, first of all, the short answer is not successful, because the chaos emanates from the top. You can't create a better team by getting rid of, I don't know, Sean Spicer or even Jared Kushner and leaving in place a president who is both mentally incompetent to be the commander-in-chief and morally incompetent. And I think that this idea that somehow they'll wave a magic wand, they'll hire a few new staff, it's not going to end the chaos. And even if they wanted to, they're not going to find the caliber staff, because one of the things that happened with Nixon is after Nixon became this sort of toxic political figure, they found it very hard to get and to keep top people. But the difference is they already had a fully staffed administration. Nixon headed into a tailspin after several years as president. Trump has headed into a legal and moral tailspin almost immediately, which means that huge numbers of key positions are unfilled. And if you're a career lawyer, you're a career diplomat, you're a career public servant in any capacity, the idea of hitching yourself to an administration as just rotten to the core as this one, it's a very unappealing prospect. And so I think that this idea that they can somehow restaff with top caliber people and get it all right, it's a real pipe dream. But I think a bigger worry is that they have no intention of getting this right by constitutional means. And you've actually seen over the last few days a series of really disturbing reports starting to come out about their strategy in the face of legal chaos. And one of the strategies that we're hearing is that they're going to hold these mass rallies. And the only implication of holding these mass rallies is that they're going to try and use the intimidatory tactic of the mob to get around all of their constitutional woes at the moment. Now, just before we began talking, I was reading an article in the UK newspaper, The Guardian, and it was talking about the events up in Portland, Oregon, where two people were murdered by a neo-Nazi or a fascist fanatic when they tried to defend two Muslim women that he was attacking. And this has drawn worldwide condemnation, except it took Trump 3 or 4 days to even bother to condemn it in a tweet. He never made a public speech about it. He didn't make a public statement about it. He belatedly made this sort of begrudging tweet saying that it was wrong and that it had no place in America or something like that. But then the county chair of the Republican Party up in Multnomah County in Portland said on Tuesday that the party might start resorting to private security from the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters, which are these extremist militias, so that they can hold these rallies and so that they can hold events, these so-called free speech events being pushed by the alt-right in Portland this Sunday. Now, the idea of a mainstream political party in the United States embracing militias for private or paramilitary security, that's extraordinary, because paramilitary security organizations, that's what the Nazis had with the stormtroopers.
Yes.
It's what ended up being death squads in Latin America in the 1980s. I mean, once you go down the road of private paramilitary militia security, heavily armed private security, you're outside all constitutional limits. And that's the real fear.
Well,
I don't think anyone thinks that Trump can get this right by constitutional means. But the real fear is that as his position becomes more untenable, he tries to hang on to power by unleashing these extra constitutional forces.
Well, let's look at, I mean, we're talking now about the news this week and last week. I think we can assume that things will not get better for Trump, that the new normal is they will get worse. There'll be every day, there'll be more evidence of his criminal deeds, of national security violations by his campaign staff and his White House staff, maybe by himself. We've seen how he's reacted since he became president. If you were to speculate on where he will turn, what he will do a week, a month, a couple of months from now, what do you think is possible that he will attempt? What do you think is likely?
Well, as I was sort of talking about in the last answer, I think there's a real danger that he goes down a sort of mob intimidation route, that he realizes that his power lies not in Congress, his power lies not in the courts, but his power lies with these very angry and energized and oftentimes armed crowds. And once you make that decision, if you decide you're going to counter the special prosecutor or counter a congressional investigation by whipping up a mob, which they've certainly been talking about, if you read the conversations that have been going on about their strategy, once you unleash that kind of force into the heart of American politics, all bets are off. And so, you know, when I look over the next months or even years, it seems to me that, you know, by all normal measures, Trump is a mortally wounded political creature. He's somebody who's lost, if he ever had, he's lost all moral credibility. He's lost all constitutional legitimacy. He's being protected up to a point by Republicans in Congress who think they can use him even though they don't like him. By all rational measures, this is a deeply, deeply devastated presidency. But Trump doesn't behave or abide by limits. He doesn't behave rationally or abide by the limits of rational governance. And the danger is that he becomes increasingly erratic, authoritarian, that he might create some kind of Reichstag fire moment, some kind of emergency to either personalized power or to declare some form of emergency rule. Now, whether or not he'll succeed, I actually doubt he'll succeed. I think that the way the population in this country has been energized to fight back against Trump is actually spectacular. But I think he might try that. And I think that that's something that progressives and, frankly, anybody who's caring about constitutional government at this point should have on their radar over the coming weeks and months.
And yet, despite these frightening possibilities and predictions, you write in The Nation that Trump's increasing troubles are a cause for celebration. Why is that?
Well, I think that he's always been an illegitimate president. I think that his behavior on the campaign trail, his willingness to resort to just scandalous levels of demagoguery, his willingness to stir up racial hatreds, religious animosities, his behavior towards women, towards the disabled, you can go down the list. And at every step of the way, he has dishonored himself, and he has dishonored the institution of the presidency. And he's also made America look very, very small and irrational on the world stage. And if you look at the number of years and decades it took for America to come to occupy that position of influence globally, and you look at the way in which Trump, in the period, not of years, but of months, is squandering that, destroying the moral capital America's built up, it seems to me that it has to be a cause for celebration when a president such as himself is diminished. And of course, it will be a cause for absolute celebration when he is no longer president. And I do believe there's a strong likelihood he'll be impeached at some point. But in the interim, as we move down that road, an impeachment, even if they began the process tomorrow, which they won't, it would take many, many, many months. And what I was writing about in that article is that during that time, there is a real danger that he behaves like a cornered animal. And cornered animals can lash out in any and every direction. And that's the danger that we're dealing with for someone like Trump, that his whole life has been about power and been about getting his way. And he doesn't play by limits. He doesn't play nice. He doesn't respect rules. And all the evidence we've seen of how he behaves is that the more he feels cornered, the more dangerous he becomes. And so, yes, it's a cause for celebration that he's been weakened. Yes, it's a cause for celebration that the courts have stood up to him. Yes, it's a cause for celebration that there are now congressional and independent counsel investigations of his team. But that doesn't mean that everything is suddenly right in the world again. We've still got to be extremely vigilant as to the behaviors that he unleashes on this country.
One last thing. Some of our friends argue that if we did succeed in forcing Trump out of office, that President Mike Pence could be worse. They say Pence is more ideological, less likely to shoot himself in the foot every couple of days, likely to get a honeymoon period where people say, give him a chance, and at least he's not Trump. Aren't you afraid of Mike Pence as president?
No, I think if Mike Pence becomes president, then opinion makers on the left, of which I consider myself a part, we're going to have to work out how we approach the Pence presidency. And we're going to have to work out ways in which we can write about a man who, in many ways, as you said, is ideologically probably on a conventional measure to the right of where Trump is. Certainly on religious issues, he's shown every indication to be uncompromisingly fanatical. He probably would be worse than Trump on gay rights, for example. He'd probably be even worse than Trump, if that's possible, on Planned Parenthood and on access to abortion and so on and so forth. So, of course, if Trump gets impeached, or if Trump is declared mentally incompetent, or if Trump, for some reason, decides to resign and take a long holiday, then we have to work out how to think about and write about and talk about the Pence presidency. But in the meantime, the challenge is, what do we do with the fact that the most powerful man on earth, a man who controls thousands and thousands of nuclear missiles, seems to be deeply, deeply erratic? Not just right-wing, but fundamentally irrational in the way he behaves, in the way he thinks, in the way he talks to other people, in the way he deals with America's closest allies, in the way he praises dictators and scolds people who've been elected democratically. And that, to me, is a national catastrophe, what we're witnessing. Now, whether or not Pence does the same sorts of things, we'll have to wait and see. I doubt actually he would. But at the moment, in the year 2017, half a year into the Trump presidency, we're witnessing a complete moral implosion of America's position in the world. And I think when the historians look back on this 100, 200, 300 years from now, they're going to regard it as the single darkest moment in American history, with the possible exception of the Civil War. But they're going to be absolutely stunned that a political party stood by and for short-term political gain, for short-term gains around taxes and deregulation and so on, they were willing to shred America's global reputation and global position. And that's what we're living through at the moment.
Sasha Abramsky, his article, "Trump is a Cornered Megalomaniac," appears at thenation.com. John Dean called it a bracing analysis. Sasha, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
I'm John Wiener with Trump Watch and TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, Rick Perlstein on Trump and Nixon. That's in a minute when Trump Watch continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK and online anytime you want it at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Now it's time to ask the question, is Trump like Nixon? If you Google that question, you get something like 4 million results. News stories with headlines like, "Trump already looks like the worst of Richard Nixon." That was in the Huffington Post. Or, "Trump is Nixon without the polish." That was in the Washington Post. Or, "Trump and Nixon, the parallels are startling." That was the Guardian. But we're not so sure about that, so we want to check with Rick Perlstein. He wrote the book Nixonland, and his newest one is The Invisible Bridge. Rick writes for Mother Jones, Newsweek, Slate, and The Nation, among others. And we've seen him recently on TV with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. We reached him today in Chicago. Rick Perlstein, welcome back.
Hi, John.
Well, there's some obvious ways, let's just start with this, that Trump is not like Nixon. I just want to bounce a few of these off you very briefly. Did Richard Nixon start out in business with a $14 million loan from his father?
He was born in a house his father built. So the famous first line in his
autobiography.
Right. And then in his farewell speech to the White House, he said his dad had a lemon grove, and it was the poorest lemon grove in the entire state of California, and that he sold it, and then they immediately found oil underneath it. So, no, he came from modest circumstances, though he was lying about the oil story, so that definitely is something they do have in common.
Okay. Second, did Richard Nixon run for political office for the first time when he was 70 years old?
I believe he was the president of his high school class. He certainly was head of student government at Whittier College. So, no, he has a long, long career in the political game before he became president and before he became senator and before he even became vice president and before he became congressman.
Yeah, basically, he had no other job for most of his life except being an elected representative.
Well, he did have a brief legal career in Whittier after World War II. But he had a terrible time at it because he handled divorce cases, and women would come in and describe the problems they suffered at the marital bed. And apparently he found that excruciating.
And that leads me to my final question. Did the New York Post run a headline quoting a woman who said about Nixon, "Best sex I ever had"?
Well, I'd have to be agnostic about that. I haven't seen every New York Post headline. So we'll just have to table that question. But Hunter S. Thompson did ask Richard Nixon on the campaign trail in New Hampshire in 1968 if he'd had his annual orgasm yet.
So what do people think are the similarities? I've looked up some of these articles. Howard Feynman wrote at the Huffington Post, "Trump portrays the media as the enemy of the American people, and that's like Nixon." Do you agree with that?
Well, both certainly believed that the media was the enemy of the American people, which they, you know, defined as coextensive with themselves. But Nixon, for the most part, would never say such a thing publicly. He would, you know, send out his vice president to say it, basically.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, like that actually betokens a big difference, which is that Nixon was a very disciplined and shrewd and canny politician who knew when to play his hand and when to hold his cards close to his breast, which Donald Trump has absolutely no ability to do.
Okay, how about this one? Psychologically, they're similar. Nixon burned with resentment. He was obsessed with his enemies, just like Trump.
I think that's a pretty close match. you know, I refer to people like that as orthogonians, right? They're people who are generally kind of right-wingers who feel like they're always condescended to by, you know, the smart set, you know, all the right people. You know, he's the outer borough guy who came to Manhattan and was convinced that everyone was looking down at him. And, you know, psychologically, you know, it speaks to, you remember all Henry Kissinger's famous line? He said, what this man could have accomplished if someone had loved him when he was young.
Yeah.
This kind of void at the center of their soul, which they narcissistically have to fill with, you know, control and domination and hierarchy and authority. So, yeah, there's definitely similarity.
And here's another argument. Nixon spent the 1968 campaign claiming he had a secret plan to bring peace with honor in Vietnam. Trump claims he has a secret plan to defeat ISIS. Both of these, of course, are lies. How important is that as a similarity?
Well, I mean, again, you know, it's similar on the surface, but Nixon was very canny and deliberate about what he said and why he said it. I mean, he was on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. The specific quote was, you know, if elected, I will end the war and win the peace. You know, so it was very, very circumspect. You know, he didn't say we were going to win. He just kind of said something that was very lawyerly and legalistic and was just enough to kind of, and this was very Nixonian, the skill that he had in rhetoric. He was able to say things but have plausible deniability that he ever said it, right? So much like, you know, kind of the dog whistle on race, he kind of gave a dog whistle on Vietnam. Whereas, you know, Donald Trump, you know, just kind of would kind of blare these ridiculous things like we're going to bomb the hell out of ISIS, even though they're a, you know, insurgent movement, you know, inside of cities. You know, we're going to create safe zones within Syria, but are not going to put anyone on the ground, which, of course, he's already, you know, lied about. You know, he doesn't have that sort of shrewd ability to maneuver. You know, it's a very different kind of approach to winning supports.
And our friend Trevor Tim pointed out in The Guardian another similarity. Nixon ran for the White House by appealing for and winning the votes of resentful working class whites. We see exactly the same strategy in Trump's victory.
Sure, but there's nothing particularly fresh in that. I mean, that's been the, you know, that's Nixon land, right? I mean, that's been the Republican playbook, you know, really ever since, in a lot of ways, the Checkers speech. And it was, you know, they used to talk about Reagan Democrats. Reagan used to talk about making the Republican Party having an appeal beyond the country clubs. It's Newt Gingrich. It's Sarah Palin. I mean, to the extent that anyone wins a Republican nomination in the presidency, that's how they do it. And that's, you know, a big part of why Mitt Romney failed. He wasn't able to convincingly sell that, you know, very standard Republican script.
Okay, the biggest argument, Nixon tried to cover up the crimes Republicans committed against the Democratic Party during the 1972 campaign. Of course, that's what led to Watergate. Trump, too, is trying to cover up the crimes his campaign committed during the 2016 campaign, the way they were helped by the Russians. In both cases, crimes against the Democratic Party and the small d Democratic process, and in both cases, cover up.
Well, you know, like a lot of things with Trump, I mean, there's a similarity, but Trump, you know, turns it up to 11, as I like to say. My little brother loves the Spinal Tap reference. You know, I mean, Richard Nixon was able to do all kinds of nefarious stuff involving wiretaps and money cons and things like that. Yeah, but it wasn't until 3.5 years later that he did something that was so outrageous that he actually, you know, got caught. Trump, you know, takes him 3.5 weeks. I mean, one thing I like to say is also Donald Trump or his lawyers are very skilled money launderers. I mean, that's what the tax returns are all about. It's shell company within shell company within shell company. Watergate was, among other things, a money laundering scheme, and Richard Nixon was very poor at it. And the famous conversation with John Dean on March 21st, 1973, John Dean tried to, you know, talk him down from this crazy idea of paying off the burglars to shut up. And he said, you know, we'd need to raise $1 million. And that was a figure he just pulled out of his rear end, expecting Nixon to say, you know, yeah, you're right. You know, and John Dean said, that's the kind of thing, you know, mafia people are good at, you know, washing money. We don't know how to do that. And Richard Nixon, you know, really got his Irish up. He was, you can hear it on the tape. He's very indignant that John Dean would suggest that he was worse at money laundering than the mafia. He said, oh, you know, I absolutely know how I can get it. You know, he got it from people like the papist, the Greek businessman. He, you know, but, you know, it immediately started unspooling as soon as the FBI investigated.
One more thing I want to raise, which you've talked about elsewhere. Trump says it will all be easy for him. He will defeat ISIS quickly. He will bring back the jobs now. Healthcare will be a right. beautiful thing. What would Nixon have said to that theme?
I think he really, really would have reared up and disgusted that. Richard Nixon was, among other things, and kind of most preeminently a planner. He was very careful. He played the long game. You know, he was planning his kind of China move, you know, in some, you could argue ever since 1967 when he gave a speech at Bohemian Grove, you know. My debunking of that came during the convention, right? When Paul Manafort said they were, you know, using his 1968 inauguration speech as a model for his inauguration speech. And of course, both of them talked about law and order, but, you know, that was actually quite a gracious speech, kind of full of poetic flights of fancy.
You're talking about Nixon's
speech. Yeah. And one of the themes of the speech was, it's not going to be easy. I think he relished the slog. You know, he was called old iron butt, you know, when he was in law school, because he just loved to sit there and prepare and prepare and slog and slog and slog. And, you know, he had a very long attention span. I mean, you can listen to the tapes. He'll go through these hour-long conversations with Kissinger, in which they kind of turn over every aspect of the problem. Trump is the guy, you know, who can't even sit in a meeting without tweeting, who has the attention span of a soap bubble.
Lots of people say Trump is like Nixon, and a lot of people are already saying Trump is worse than Nixon. I would say the opposite. I mean, Nixon kept the war in Vietnam going after 1968, when the United States could have ended it, when LBJ tried to end it. And the result was that because of Nixon, we killed at least 1 million more Vietnamese and, I don't know, tens of thousands more Americans. Seems to me that is much worse than Trump.
Well, John, DJT is only just getting started. Okay. He has, you know, he's already started putting troops on the ground in Syria, and you know, if he you know, mishandles all these global hotspots with a State Department that isn't even staffed yet, you know, maybe this story will end with a nuclear holocaust. So let's be fair to the guy. You know, give him a chance.
Give him a chance. Rick Perlstein, his essay, Mr. Trump, You're No Richard Nixon, appeared in the New Republic. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, John.
Well, that's it for today's Trump Watch podcast. Trump Watch returns next week. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.